The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Four, three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for being with us today. And February goes marching on, doesn't it? Can't believe time just seems to go so fast, as we've talked about before, or at least I've talked about before. Today is open lines, which means we typically talk about the topics you mostly want to talk about. Not always, but mostly. First-time callers are certainly welcome, and anything related to space and technology and science or something generally in those categories is also welcome. I have a couple of announcements to make. So, number one, tomorrow, Monday, is a U.S. national holiday, President's Day, so there will be no Space Show program tomorrow. We typically don't do programs on national holidays or other holidays or days such as Easter or Christmas, things of that nature, New Year's. And then also we have a program on Friday, which is not really a program because I have to meet with my tax accountants on Friday. There was no other time to schedule that meeting, so regrettably there will be no Space Show program on Friday of this week as well. So, again, no program tomorrow, Monday, because of the national holiday, President's Day, and no program on Friday due to my non-Space Show business schedule. Other than that, the toll-free number for today, if you would like to call us on open lines, is 1-866-687-7223, and currently the line is not turned on. I'll tell you when it is turned on because I have a couple of announcements to talk about. You can also email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And, of course, you can post comments on our blog. And to do that, go to our website, thespaceshow.com. And on the far right is the upcoming show menu. And this is the first program listed. That is the blog page for this program. So open it up in comments and questions are down at the bottom, and as soon as you post a comment or a question, I can receive it and I can integrate it into the program. A couple of other quick things to remind you. The toll-free number is the preferred way of communicating with us, so do let me repeat it, and I'll repeat it several times during the show. 1-866-687-7223, and I will tell you when I have turned it on. Please do visit the spaceshow.com website. So the website newsletter will be posted shortly after today's program ends, and it will have the programs for this week, which include Mark Whittington on the Great Moon Debate in Utah, and that is Tuesday, and then Dwight Stephen Bonicki has a great new space history book out, taking a fresh look at the Apollo-Soyuz test flight and test project, and that will be on Sunday. Again, no show on Monday, no show on Friday. If you want to subscribe to the email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning, 6 a.m. California time, electronically, please send me your email address. Remember, everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily download the shows. In the upper left-hand corner of our website is a menu, and if you go under Support, you'll see our Space Show Cafe Press store where you can buy Space Show logo wear and other things as well. So if you check it out, let me know. If you have any suggestions, feedback, always glad to hear from you. Another item on that upper left menu is Listen Live. So you can share this information, by the way, with others. But this tells you how to listen to a live Space Show program, archive programs on our website, and podcasting. And then also those of you that are using Alexa, the embedded Alexa player TuneIn is there, and you can use that for listening to our shows on Alexa. If you go center right, you'll see the Support the Space Show area. So remember, we're a listener-supported 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And without your financial support, we will disappear. And I guess that's a blunt way of saying it. So we do thank you very much for your support. Remember, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, you get a tax deduction, as we're a California public benefit corporation. We thank you very much for your support, those of you who have supported us, those of you who continue to support us, and those of you who will be supporting us. You can get more information at our nonprofit website, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, or simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. In addition to the individual sponsorships, we do have company or business sponsorships, and you can see the banner ads for some of our sponsors going across our homepage. So when you do become a sponsor, you get a banner ad that rotates across our homepage, and you can change that banner ad pretty much as often as you like. I also read a 60-second or less spot that you create that promotes your business or says whatever it is you want to say. And I read that on every full-length Space Show program like today. And on shorter programs, when we do the 60-minute format, I simply mention all the sponsors by name and thank them. We do have a couple of sponsorships left, although people are considering it. So we don't do too many because reading the 60-second messages on air does eat into guest talk time. So I need to hold that down to a minimum. But if you are interested in having your banner ad go across the homepage and delivering a 60-second or less promo message on every Space Show program, and this includes the archive programs, excuse me, give me an email. Let me know. We'll talk about it. DrSpace, DrSpace, @thespaceshow.com. Remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked. And, you know, you're entitled to download our shows. Please don't do anything commercial. Don't copy or edit or clip anything. Don't put anything up on YouTube or other websites. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. We thank Gigadial and Andrew for our podcasting service, and we're very appreciative of that. And our sponsors for the first segment of today's program include the Integrated Space Plan, and this is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of different elements in the more detail at thespaceplan.com. And they have lots of interactive activity on their website. They have different versions. They have an academic version and a full version. It's a very inspiring space plan, and you ought to have it. So take a look at it at thespaceplan.com. In addition, my voice is still not totally normal, as you can hear from my bronchitis attack earlier this year. Space Foundation is our sponsor with the 34th Space Symposium just around the corner. April 16th through the 19th, again at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Visit spacesymposium.org for all the details. It is a must-attend space industry event, the best networking ever. Check it out, and I hope you can attend. And then we'll tell you about the other sponsors in the second segment of our program. So I don't really have announcements for topics to talk about, but I want to give you a few comments based on emails that I've gotten during the week and activity on the blog and the website. So number one is Fremont John followed up with comments I made earlier about the Space Show Board and Advisory Board. So I'm going to update you on that. So first of all, I was not ever, nor am I, talking about the Board of Directors. So please don't be confused about that. I was talking about revising the Advisory Board with more involved, more active participants. The problem that hit me, besides by being really sick in most of January and early February, was the fact that I had to make this sudden move. And the move has been extremely challenging. I'm by far not anywhere as close to having moved in. I'm surrounded by boxes. The people that were helping me got really sick. They ended up in the hospital with that flu and virus that everybody's been reading about in the paper. They still have not been able to return to help me, and I still have not been able to return to full strength. and then a couple of other things happened, and so the board meeting that I need to have with One Giant Leap to move forward with some of the things I talked to you about before, including the restructuring of the advisory board, has not happened yet. And I'm behind on that. So I can't revise and re-energize the advisory board until I do the board meeting. And I'm hoping that I can get this done within the next couple of weeks, and I will keep you posted on that. So nothing has happened. You now know why nothing has happened. And again, I'm talking about the advisory board, not the board of directors. Okay, so, and there's a big difference between the two. All right, so I'll keep you posted, and when I'm able to actually reformulate the advisory board, there are some people I'd like to invite to join us, I will do so. I also previously talked about qualifications for it. So I'll just run over the qualifications. So first of all, there have to be involved people in the space show. They should be supporters of the show. They should help support us at some level. And, you know, they need to be broad picture, big picture people. They can't be focused on their own little agenda and then want to slant space show programming or suggestions toward meeting their own sort of agenda or individual type of objectives. So again, this is big picture industry overall type of viewpoints, perspectives, and assistance that is typical with an advisory board. Being involved, being supportive of the space show, and having contributed to it, and being big picture minded, not driven by an agenda, those are all really important attributes for advisory board members. Another thing that has come up over the past couple of weeks is this actually come up on the space show in the past, and I haven't said anything about it, but I'm going to say something about it this time, and this is what I refer to as hijacking the blog. So for the most part, the space show blog welcomes comments, and we hope the comments are relevant to the topics discussed on the program with the guest or guests that were on the program. You know, anything is fair game about the content of the program. But sometimes, and this happened recently, somebody starts commenting on the blog on something that has nothing to do with the program. And then it turns into a one, two, or three-person private exchange with dozens of blog posts and emails going back and forth on topics that don't have anything to do with the space show program. The guests end up being very disappointed that there are no comments about their show discussion on the blog. And the reason there aren't is because those individuals that have taken it over with the non-relevant kind of individual messages that they want to go back and forth have prevented other people from participating. They either tune it out completely because they don't care about the private conversation going on, or they just, you know, hijacked it and they don't feel like there's any reason to try to get in or start another discussion because it doesn't go anywhere. So I ask you that if you're going to comment and talk about something that has nothing to do with the space shuttle program, take it off the blog and do it privately with the people that may be interested in that. And don't usurp the blog for your own individual purposes and agenda, because it's really there for people to comment on the programming and what the guest may have had to say. And I don't think it's fair to the guest, and I don't think it's fair to the other listeners to have the blog hijacked into a discussion that ends up being 35, 40, 50 blog posts going back and forth between one or two people, maybe three, about something that was never even brought up on the show. So, you know, I'm not going to delete the messages. I'm not going to block you from using the blog. But I do hope that you will use some common sense here and some courtesy and some consideration to the guest and others that may actually want to comment on the, what the guest had to say and the programming question. I mean, not always does anyone want to do that. I agree with that. I mean, there are a lot of spatial programs where there are zero comments on the blog. But anyway, keep that in mind. And if you do want to have an ongoing private discussion that's not relevant to the program, take it offline. Go exchange all the notes you want among yourselves. And we would, and I especially, would really appreciate your courtesy about that. Okay, and another thing is I got an email from a gentleman about a recent show with Ashwan Vasabada of JPL, who was talking about a rover's updates on Mars, what's on Mars, maybe fossils on Mars, things like that. And he was very unhappy that Ashwan didn't talk about some alternative things, including different perspectives on the famous Mars meteorite that was found here on Earth, and other papers and projects, including things that Dr. Zubrin has written. And his private email to me was, in a kind of a way, you should have busted this guy and held him accountable. So that's not my purpose on the show. My purpose is to invite people of all different perspectives and all different cultures and all different opinions, and to let them talk about their expertise in whatever the topic is. And I'm not there to bust their chops or to hold them accountable or to do something to attack their credibility. But you guys can do that as long as your tone is civil and you do it in a very polite way. So I publish the list of who the speakers are and the topics, often weeks if not months in advance of their being on the air. And they're in the upcoming guest section of the website newsletter that I talk about on every show. And they're also published a week before the show in the upcoming show menu on the Space Show. And they're on the website newsletter, as I said. And they're in the email newsletter for the week they're going to be on the show. So look, if you can't listen live, what is stopping you from sending in an email in advance of the show saying, what about this, this, and this? Okay? I guess what I'm saying is the listener, excuse me, have a responsibility to hold guests accountable for what they say. If you have information that they may or may not cover, if you follow alternative sites like, you know, the stuff this person brought up about Mars and the Mars meteorite and fossils and other things, ask them about it, and I'll read your email on air. Again, the only requirement is civility. Okay? So you, the listener, have a responsibility here as well. You know who the guests are ahead of time, almost all the time. I mean, sometimes we have a cancellation and a last-minute guest and you don't know what's going on, but that doesn't happen that often. And come on, don't look to me to hold them accountable for that which interests you. First of all, I don't know what interests you. unless you somehow tell me. And don't look to me to hold their feet to the fire if they're saying traditional things and conservative things that you don't believe in and you think they should be far more out there. But you can do that, and I encourage you to do that. So you have a role in the space show with the guest as well, and please accept it, and please follow through on it. I guess that's what I'm saying. I want to hear from you. I'll read your emails on the air if I get them, before the show or during the show. And I understand you can't always listen live, but we do publish who's going to be on the show, and there's plenty of opportunity for you to kind of know what they talk about and what their positions are. And if you have things that are burning and passionate within you, shoot them over to me and I'll ask the guest about it. Okay, another thing I want to talk about is controversy plus, and that comes in the form of Dr. John Brandenburg. So whenever Dr. Brandenburg is on the show, and, you know, he was just on talking about his new science fiction book, he completed his UFO trilogy, UFO Wars, but he also talked about his gem theory, which is being continued to evolve and develop, and he also, again, gave us some updates, or there really aren't any updates, regarding his thesis that there were hydrogen bomb blasts on Mars maybe 100 million years ago that destroyed the planet. Like everybody else, it is a pretty hard jump in reality to accept the fact that there were hydrogen bomb blasts on Mars now or 100 million years ago or whenever. I mean, that is a big leap. And I certainly own up to it. But I've done some research on this. And I have read the reviewed papers that have been published by teams of people looking at the SAR data from Curiosity, which is where most of this research comes from. Some of it comes from Viking. So here is what is known factually. Xenon 129 is in greater ratio proportions on Mars than other xenon isotopes, krypton isotopes, and other isotopes. That is factual. That is very well documented. The peer-reviewed literature and the papers published by academics and people at NASA and JPL do not theorize on why there are greater ratios and proportions of xenon 129 on Mars than other xenon isotopes. What they say is to understand this, here's the favorite science buzzword, right? We need more research. We need to do more study. They don't go into any kind of explanation of why these ratios of xenon 129 are higher on Mars than other xenon isotopes. I've not found any attempt at an explanation of that. However, in a couple of the papers, I did find some notations that xenon 129, can come about because of a big major event that John has talked about, which we know has not happened on Mars, and that's about it. Okay, so here comes Brandenburg. So Brandenburg is a fringe kind of guy. And, he has been attacked for his fringe work in the past on Cydonia, the face on Mars, and probably some things that I don't even know about. So he is willing to be out there on the fringe, and maybe he's willing to be out there beyond the fringe. But that's Brandenburg. He is a plasma physicist for real. He did work in nuclear weapons for real at Lawrence Livermore and the other labs. And he does know what he's talking about. And he is a real scientist. And he does present at peer-reviewed conferences dealing with physics and other issues. I have been to a few of his presentations at AIAA, and he packs the room solid. He goes over his time limit, and nobody leaves the room, and the room has other scientists and physicists in the room, and they seriously pay attention to him, and they ask him very high-quality questions, including on his hydrogen bomb theory on Mars. So Brandenburg looks at this and says, wonder why there's xenon 129 in greater ratios on Mars. How did this happen? Because we know there hasn't been any major radiation or event like we know that can bring that about, and that is talked about in the literature, and nobody says that there's been any kind of events like that on Mars. So Brandenburg knows that xenon 129, now here comes some of the controversy with many of the blog posters on the Space Show blog and probably elsewhere too, is a byproduct of thermonuclear atmospheric testing on Earth. And you can look at the levels of xenon 129 in the atmosphere, and they climb as a result of our period of atmospheric weapons testing. Now, some people don't accept this or are critical of this because the amount of megatonnage of H-bombs blown up in the atmosphere is not very high. But that is a poor way to try to calculate this, because as the testing developed and as technology improved, nuclear weapons technology became more efficient in smaller amounts. So, this is far beyond my pay grade, but I've had it explained to me by many nuclear weapons people. And so what they say is they are able to have more destructive outcomes with smaller bomb blast than in the early days of atmospheric testing. And they can vary the percentage of fission versus fusion products in a bomb blast. So all of this would affect xenon 129 being left over in the atmosphere. So just using, say, how much megatonnage was blown up during our atmospheric testing period on Earth would not be a good test of this, because you'd have to look and see how the bombs were made more efficient. You'd have to look and see what the percentage of fission versus fusion material was in those bombs and how they were constructed to see what the outcome was. Okay, so Brandenburg is capable of doing that. And furthermore, Brandenburg has access to the literature because he was part of a lot of that going on way back when. So he says, okay, if xenon 129 is in Earth's atmosphere because of nuclear weapons testing during our atmospheric period, then how did it get on Mars? Well, we know there's no major, solar radiation type of burst that can create it. So it's a byproduct of thermonuclear bombs, hydrogen bombs, going off in an atmosphere. Therefore, one theory, notice the word theory, is that there were some really huge hydrogen-like bombs blown up on Mars 100 million years ago, which killed the planet or pulverized the planet. And that is a theory. So a theory is out there to be proven wrong or right. Doesn't mean it's real, but it's a theory on explaining xenon 129 higher percentages in the Martian atmosphere. That's all it is a theory. Now, as I said, when I've gone through the reviewed literature from the SARS papers on Curiosity, and there's quite a few of them. I mean, you could spend a couple of hours reading them. Nobody offers an explanation for how xenon 129 in higher ratio proportions got on Mars. And all they do is say, more study, more study, more research. And, that's a viable approach to take. And how do we do more study? How do we get more information? Well, it would be nice to get credible boots on Mars someday and go to some of these areas and do a little geological digging and testing and this and that and the other. But, you know, getting to Mars is expensive. It's hard. And, they usually go to sites based on the decadal survey, And so the likelihood of them going to a site to test Brandenburg's theory is not high. Now, would a private party going to Mars, say, choose to go to a Brandenburg site to test his theory? Probably not, unless it was a Brandenburg private research project. So how do you prove the theory? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it may be a theory that is out there for all time's sake, unless somebody comes up with a more plausible explanation for how Xenon 129 got on Mars. Now, anyone, myself included, can have an opinion. And that opinion does not have to be based on fact, doesn't have to be based on education. It could be based on comic books, on Marvel comic books, for all I know. I mean, and we're all welcome to have our opinions, and people who have opinions like to post on the blog. But that doesn't mean you know anything about the subject. And so people reading blog comments, myself included, need to always be diligent that what you're reading maybe doesn't have any basis in fact at all. Could just be someone's opinion because this is what they think or this is what they want to believe. So you can like Brandenburg's theory. You can think it sucks. You can think he's Looney Tunes or wackadoodle. What are the other plausible scientific, factual ways that Xenon 129 could be in higher percentages in the Martian atmosphere? So someone posted on the blog today that it could have come in from another planet, you know, and been deposited on Mars. Okay, what's the science behind that theory? So you ought to be able to do a little bit of due diligence and see if Xenon 129 can be transported that way. And I would suspect that you would not be able to validate that idea. But you can post that idea on the blog and use that to refute Brandenburg if you want. But here's the problem, and it's a problem for John, and it's a problem for people who actually care about this, and that is that the idea that there were nuclear hydrogen bomb explosions on Mars 100 million years ago that destroyed the planet is really a hard pill to accept. Nobody likes that theory. Okay? It reeks of total crackpot, wackadoodle, fringe crapola. However, nobody, not even the blogs that I have read that attack Brandenburg for being a phony scientist, and there are a lot of them, they don't give a plausible explanation for how the Xenon 129 got there. They just say he's a wackadoodle, and he's does faux science, F-A-U-X. So I would love to see John's theory either proven or discarded scientifically while I'm still doing the space show. I bet John would like to see that too. But it is, listeners, just a theory. And if someone out there has a factual, plausible, alternative theory of how Xenon 129 got on Mars, put it out there. And so far, nobody has done that I know of. I've not found any literature putting out an alternative, factual scenario for Xenon 129 on Mars. So there you have it. And you can post your opinions and you can opine like an expert or an amateur until hell freezes over, as a famous politician once said. Brandenburg has a factual theory. And I think if you don't like it, help us find another factual explanation for how Xenon 129 got there. And I don't think the NASA people and the Mars people care anything about this, and they don't feel any pressure or any obligation to come up with a quick and dirty Xenon 129 explanation. In fact, the people that I've had on the show from NASA and JPL claim they don't even know Brandenburg or what his theory is about. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I mean, it may be they consider him so out on a fringe that they don't want to acknowledge his existence. I don't know the answer to that one either. So I just wanted to say this. I understand Brandenburg's theory and argument, and I understand why people don't want to accept it, and I understand what an opinion is. And until I see another factual explanation for Xenon 129, and by factual it means it has to be supported as something that can happen. Like, we do know Xenon 129 is a byproduct of nuclear thermal weapons, okay? Well, come up with another plausible factual theory. We're all waiting for it. And Brandenburg will continue to be a guest on the Space Show. I like the guy. He's a good friend. I have a lot of fun doing the shows with him. He's fully aware that this is a wild-ass theory. And he's fully prepared to debate anyone on it, and he's fully prepared to look at plausible alternatives. So he's a pretty open-minded guy. More open-minded than those of you that are posting critical comments about his theory. Anyway, I just wanted to put that out there. I'd love to see another factual, plausible explanation for Xenon 129 on Mars, and maybe someday we will get that. And if we do get that, you will hear about it on the Space Show. So if anybody sees that in a peer-reviewed paper or a scientific journal or something, please, please, please call it to my attention, and I'll do a show about it, because I may miss it, and many of you look at things that I don't get to see. So you're my eyes and ears out there. So do keep me posted on that. I have turned on the toll-free line. And it is available if anyone is still listening to this show and wants to call in. And again, anything is a fair topic. Maybe you want to talk about the Falcon Heavy launch. And the line is ringing now. The Falcon Heavy launch was way cool. I think it's still a little undecided as to exactly how it will play out and what it will mean. But it's really was really phenomenal. And I hope all of you got to see it live. I was out and about, but pulled over off the freeway and watched it streaming off the SpaceX website on my iPhone. So I saw it in smaller detail than I would have liked, but at least I saw it live. And somebody may want to talk about Falcon Heavy. Let's see who our caller is. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. And who are you and where are you?
Hi, this is John in Montana, and I know the phone connections are very iffy, despite living in the United States in the 21st century.
Well, you sound good, but from that email you sent to Logan and Adamo this morning, I thought you would be out struggling to get hay to your starving cattle.
Taking care of that. Now I'm trying to warm up again. It's still snowing like mad.
So is it harsher in Montana out on your ranch or harsher on the surface of Mars?
Mars.
And it's pretty bad, as you said, on the surface of Montana today, right?
I'll tell you, the difference in at least my ability to work outside, say in May or June or July, as opposed to January or February, is really striking. And every time I go out to do outside work when the weather conditions aren't so good, I really appreciate how tough that is, whether it's in Montana in the winter or Antarctica or on Mars. And at least I have air to breathe.
Yeah, and you can have water and you have gravity.
And I have gravity and water and no radiation, and I don't have toxic perchlorates and other superoxides laying around that are extremely horribly toxic on the ground, and I have to keep them out of my habitat.
And no dust and no dust storms to deal with too, I would imagine, right?
No, you have dust storms here.
You do. Well, what is on your mind, and did I blow my Brandenburg discussion, or give me a grade on it? Because I'm far from being a physicist, as everyone knows.
I'll give you a B on it, and okay. I'll get into that in a minute. The first thing, I think it was great that you brought up some of the issues related to management of the space show and how it's managed, the interrelationship between the board of directors and the advisory board and so on. I think that's healthy to bring that out for listeners periodically. Second, with respect to Dr. Brandenburg, I don't have any quibble with what you say except for one thing, and that is I would not call his ideas a theory. I would call them an hypothesis. And at least in my mind, a hypothesis is a proposed explanation for observed phenomena. Now, the xenon excess on Mars relative to the Earth is an observed fact, as you said correctly, but the explanation is being put forth as an hypothesis rather than as a theory. Other than that, I don't have any gripes about it.
What is the actual difference between a hypothesis and a theory?
Well, people argue about that all the time, but my idea, for what it's worth, is that a hypothesis is an explanation for things that you've observed. And it's not really tested by experiment, whereas a theory is something that occurs when you take an hypothesis and subject it to experimental test, and the experimental results then are factored into the mix, and at that point it becomes a theory to either be proven or disproven by further experiment.
Okay, so we're...
Other people may disagree with that, but that's kind of my working definitions for the two.
So the hypothesis is much more basic than the theory.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
The third thing on my mind, which exhausts my mind completely, is the Falcon Heavy. And as I mentioned in the email to Dan Adamo and Jim Logan, I think that the point-to-point transportation issue is really very, very, very iffy using the BFR that is supposed to be coming down the line.
And why do you say that?
Well, number one, the delta V for a ballistic trajectory from point to point that covers a large fraction of the Earth's circumference ends up being very, very close to the delta V required to put something into LEO. And then if you're going to land it with rocket power and kind of reverse the process, that's going to take more delta V. And so you've got a lot of delta V you're playing with in order to do that point-to-point. Now, the BFR is, by definition, a big rocket. Big rockets are very noisy, and the whole transportation thing, if you're going to compete with something like FedEx or UPS, is that you are trying to increase the transportation speed, but that's from the source to the destination, and it's not just from point A to point B with one mode of transportation. And so if you have a package and you want to send it by FedEx to somebody in some other place on the Earth, you have the package picked up. It's taken to a local distribution center. From there, it goes to a central distribution center, and then to another local distribution center, and then to the final destination. And there might be even more steps involved in that process. But those transportation steps all take time. And so even if you take the time for a major link and reduce it down to almost zero, you still have significant time. So that's a problem. The second problem is you can perhaps get around that by having launch and landing sites scattered around the way airports are scattered around, but I don't think that's going to happen with great big rockets for a lot of reasons, only one of which is noise. But with aircraft, you can get rapid transportation if necessary. You can charter a G5 or something and take out of an airport with a couple thousand foot runway and fly to your ultimate destination, or fly your package to somewhere else where you put it on a big plane, maybe even a commercial flight, and it goes somewhere else and eventually makes it to its final destination. With the BFR, you're only taking out one link in that process. And then also, as a potential shipper, you look at what are you gaining. Right now, you can put a package just about anywhere in roughly a day. And what kinds of freight or packages require faster delivery than that? And so the difference in what you're going to be supplying for that kind of transportation, assuming it exists, is going to be things that have a very short life of some sort. And the example that I think about is a donor heart that's being transported for transplant into some patient somewhere else. And again, that's a very small fraction of all the stuff that's being shipped around. And so how much market can you capture with a relatively expensive, extremely noisy transportation modality that will only be operating from a relatively few number of bases or spaceports, because you can't take a BFR-type rocket and launch it or land it, say, at O'Hare Airport or Kennedy or LAX or SFO in San Francisco or some of the smaller airports that you have scattered around the country. So that's my beef with the idea of using it for point-to-point transportation.
You have an email from a listener.
Oh.
So this is from Joshua in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he says, Dr. Juris, from your knowledge and expertise, which you have talked about before on the space show, regarding weapons and nuclear this and that, what can possibly create higher ratios of xenon-129? Can it only come from a bomb blast, or is there another possible source of it?
I'll never say only, but the sources that I know about are a thermonuclear weapon or a supernova. And anybody is welcome to come up with another mechanism that explains it in the quantities that are observed. But I don't know. I'm just not smart enough.
So it wouldn't, so like, I think it was Bijan, but I may be wrong on that, posted a comment where maybe it could have come in from another planet, like other things are transported by planets and solar wind and things like that and gotten to Mars.
Well, okay, if it's coming in from a planet or an asteroid or whatever, the question is, where did that body originate and how did it pick up the excess xenon at its point of origination? If that's another solar system, maybe that's the case, but then you're positing a planet, say, in orbit around some star. If the star blows up, the planet picks up a lot of xenon and then travels with that xenon through interstellar space and eventually smacks into Mars and deposits its xenon there. The xenon has a half-life. I don't remember what it is. The xenon-129, and it's going to be decaying the whole time. And so whether that is enough to explain it, I'd have to look at the numbers, and I just don't know.
So a star someplace has a supernova, 129 is created and travels somehow and ends up on Mars.
That is my understanding of what he's talking about, but he being the author of the email. I just don't know. I don't have enough information available at my fingertips to even comment, other than along the lines that I've just discussed.
And I know you've read a lot of the reviewed papers from the SARS instrument on Curiosity. That seems to be where most of the current information is coming from. Have you ever seen any of these academics or scientists or people postulate why there's more 129 on Mars?
No. Don't forget, the instrumentation people are concentrating on measurements and whether the measurements are any good. and how reliable they are and that sort of thing. So they're just saying, here it is. Here's what we find, and then they walk away from it.
And more study is needed, meaning more money, please.
Oh, sure. And that's entirely reasonable. I think this process needs more study, and that's great. Now, some of that study could be done theoretically in terms of looking at the various known potential precursors that could decay into xenon 129, and more power to the people that can do that and perform that type of analysis. And if they come up with an explanation, I would love to hear an explanation of that anomaly on xenon on Mars. And remember, also, Dr. Brandenburg has mentioned a few other things that tend to support what he's talking about, including relative thorium concentrations and some other things on Mars. And he's postulated or hypothesized that the major sources of xenon on Mars came from two different places on the surface of Mars, if I remember correctly.
That is what his ideas suggest. He must have a lot of guts to put that out there, because he's got to know the attacks and what's going to happen, because nobody, including yourself, wants to accept that big H bombs were blown up on Mars and destroyed the planet.
Of course, but his personality apparently is such that he's willing to stand up there and say, "Here it is. Now, send the incoming. Take the incoming,
and show me where I've gone wrong." It was interesting at the AIAA thing, where he packed the room out into the hallway, and there were many real physicists and scientists in that room, and they were all asking him questions about it, and nobody, but you can hear it. I mean, I would imagine it's on the internet.
Right.
Nobody postulated a different explanation for the 129.
I wonder what percentage of the audience would go out of there and say, "I can't be seen in public with you, but good job."
I don't know. They were in the room. They were in the room with him, and they didn't leave. Matt is in Germany listening to the show, and he has a question for you. You may be the guest today, John, for all I know. Do you believe that BFR's rocket engines, Raptor, reliably can be increased to a level as displayed by present jet engines? That means an increase by several orders of magnitude as required for such a transport system.
Time will tell. My understanding is that SpaceX is looking at methane for doing that, and I do know that methane as a propellant offers some other advantages over RP-1 or whatever, in that in a reusable rocket engine, you don't want a lot of coke deposits in the propellant passageways. And methane is a little cleaner that way than is a kerosene-like derivative. So they're going along that route. And I know that has been a problem based on some other companies that have been looking at the pros and cons of different propellants.
Now, I have something else for you, because Jeff Bell came out of the woodwork again last night and is coming on the show, okay?
Good.
And he sent me several emails, but he's going to be on, everybody, Monday, March 12th. And by the way, Dr. Bob Zubrin is going to be on March 13th. So Zubrin has found errors in the Drake equation, has postulated a really good paper about that. It's on Centauri Dreams. Plus, Zubrin has posted several articles and op-eds on the significance of Falcon Heavy for all sorts of different things. So Zubrin will be on the 13th. Bell is on the 12th. So among the many things that Jeff pointed out to me in an email, he says, a book is being republished and will be available on Amazon. It's called Ignition, an informal history of liquid rocket propellants. It has been discussed several times on your show. Rutgers is reprinting it in May. I've already pre-ordered it on Amazon. He wants me to send one to all of my new space friends. Yeah, right. You want to pay for it, John? I mean, Jim. Especially ones advocating new fuels that were rejected in the 60s. So you're a history guy. You know fuels and liquid rocket propellants. Are you familiar with this book? Again, it's called Ignition, An Informal History of Liquid Rocket Propellants.
No, I'm not.
Well, I'm going to find it on Amazon. I guess they're taking pre-orders for it. And he says Rutgers is publishing. It might be a good book to get a hold of.
Might be. My guess is that the reason for using kerosene initially was that it's readily available because of its use as a fuel on jet engines. And it works, and it's also not a cryogenic propellant. And so that makes it easier to handle, but people have been handling liquid oxygen as the oxidizer for many years, and that is cryogenic. So to me, that's not really an issue anymore. The question is relative availability, cost, and the physical properties of the propellant.
Jeff also sent in the topics for the show. Listeners, I'll just give you a little bait here to hopefully some of you will want to listen on the 12th. Topics, failure of the Red Dragon project and its implications for Big Fantasy Rocket. Recall, I predicted the collapse of Red Dragon several shows ago due to the fundamental incompatibility of the Dragon shape with the thin atmosphere of Mars. You and a lot of other people didn't believe that Musk could make such a big mistake. Number two, BFR upper stage as a suborbital transport, another sci-fi idea that won't work. Three, collapse of the Russian space program, endless Angara delays, pending loss of outside income. And final, rash of launch failures in long-established programs, Soyuz, Proton, and Ariane 5. This is just a sampling of what I would like to talk about on the 12th.
Sounds like an interesting show.
Yep, and Jeff, for those of you who don't know him, likes to get in people's face and likes to be a contrarian, and no doubt on the 12th he will live up to his reputation, but he is factual, and he does seem to be able to support what he says. Anything else from your perspective, John?
Nope.
Thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Stay warm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listeners, can you believe we're an hour into the show already? Well, I guess that's my long-winded opening stuff and then talking to John. The toll-free number is available if anybody is out there listening and wants to give us a call. 1-866-687-7223. And here we go. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you?
This is Marshall in the metropolis of Renfrew, Oklahoma.
Okay, Marshall, we all know you live in a magnanimous, magnificent city, so you don't need to keep reminding us that you're in one of the rare cities on Earth today. We're all envious of you. What's up?
Well, I thought I should comment about Brandenburg because I watched one of his lectures on rocket engines and was totally fascinated. I didn't realize he was a nuclear physicist also. So, wow. As far as the Mars thing goes, I like to think of it as a paradox. And a paradox is one of those things that you ask a question and there just isn't an answer. And the answer you get is totally different from what you think it should be. Hey. It's part of the intellectual, thing of high intelligent people. They look at paradox and study it. It's their fun thing to do. So
yeah, it is. If you don't get bent out of shape by it, and a lot of people apparently get bent out of shape by it.
Oh, definitely. I remember Enrico Fermi came up with his paradox. If there's aliens out there, why haven't we met them yet? And that was like, what was it, 63 or something like that?
Uh-huh.
you know, it's still sitting out there going, well, nobody's got a solution for that. Well, yeah, this is the best place in the whole universe to be. Why aren't they here?
Well, maybe they are here, and we just don't know it, right?
Well, there's that theory, too. Anyway, my reason for calling, we kind of discussed it a little bit before. Last Sunday, I made the comment about the Falcon Heavy launch is a paradigm shift. And one of the things that's come out of it is I realized that the International Space Station is scheduled to be decommissioned in 2024. Which means, gee, we're going to be looking at something like a Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy building a new space station. And I came in there and went, oh, gee, what's the cost? Here's my design. And I came up with, very interesting. I think we could build a space station in equatorial low Earth orbit, which means you get rid of the radiation problem. And I think it can be done for about $250 million. Wow, that's phenomenal. There's, you know, your paradigm shift. The key thing is, what are the requirements you're going to put on your space station? What do you want it to do? Well, we need to have it to do something that the International Space Station didn't do. One, it didn't test out artificial gravity. Okay, artificial gravity is very important, and no work has been done on it. So there's a great area of intellectual mining that can be done there. Second thing I came up with is the fact that, they did a little token. We grew a couple of, you know, soybean sprouts and a couple of flowers, and they had a project called Veggie One that grew lettuce, but they've done nothing in space farming. Well, if you have a 1G space station, you can do space farming. And if you can do space farming, that means the cost of keeping an astronaut in space is about $4,000 a day for food. Oh, gee, that means that we can reduce that cost down to where basically you can start living in space reasonably well. So this comes up with the following requirements for our next space station. One, it should be twice as large as the International Space Station. Okay. Two, we need to have four couples concurrently living on the station for 6 months. And I chose couples because if you got a colony in space, most of the people are going to be paired up. Plus the fact that you need to have equal representation of male and female and all that. Then the next thing you have to do is you have to say you have to have expandability. The station has to be upgradable to where it's larger for whatever's needed experimentally. And the fourth thing is, in a year of farming, the station must produce enough food for the four couples to live 6 months. In other words, half your food has to come from the space station itself. Now, gee, what's that worth? Well, somewhere between $4 and $8 billion, and instead of coming from NASA, it should be a DARPA prize. So hey, you know, everybody go out there and start looking and figuring out how to do this. I think it'll turn out to be fun.
Did you look, as I suggested, at the companies planning commercial space stations and see what their costs are and what they're planning to have their commercial space stations do?
Well, I looked at Axion, and basically it looked to me like he's just wanting the federal government to continue funding of the International Space Station through him and quote-unquote commercialize it. But at the, 51.6 degree inclination, I don't think the International Space Station can actually be too useful. plus the fact that at that inclination you have problems with getting too close to the Van Allen, the north and south edges of the Van Allen belt, and which produces a bit of a radiation problem. And I think over the last, I guess it's 18, 19 years, most of the research for zero-G that's really of interest has already been done. So I don't really see a great value in ISS.
Okay. What else? Is that the end of your call, or do you have something else you want to share?
Oh, well, no, that's pretty much it. If some people, you know, want to conversate on it, give them my email address, and we'll see if we can't set up a blog or a dialogue that we can go back and forth on.
Well, this is relevant to our program discussion today, so you could discuss it on the blog if they want to do it. Because you brought this up on the blog. So, and if you want to post any of the material that you emailed me, go ahead and you're welcome to put that up on the blog as well.
Oh, okay. I will cut the 11 pages down a bit. How's that?
Yeah, that would, succinct is an operative word here.
Yeah.
So that would be fine.
Oh, one last item.
Yes.
I spent about 2 weeks thinking about this. And as a design verification engineer, I have a strong tendency to find and look for what I call showstoppers. You know, is there something wrong with this concept that will stop it? And the only showstopper in the next generation space station that I could come up with was Congress. So if we can just get a favorable ruling out of Congress, maybe we could get a really new, interesting, and put us out there another two steps in space.
Okay, Marshall, thank you for your call, and we'll look for whatever it is you post up on the blog, and we'll stay in touch, of course.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. So, listeners, that opens up that toll-free line, and it is 1-866-687-7223. If you would like to give us a call, I think I'm going to take a quick break. Maybe some other people will want to call. Well, the phone's ringing, so I won't take the break. Stand by, everybody. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Open lines. Who are you? Where are you?
Hey, David. This is Terry in Cuero, Texas.
Hi, Terry. How's it going?
Oh, it's going fine.
What's up?
Just thinking. Falcon Heavy was exciting. That was probably about the most exciting launch I've seen in many, many years. So, real happy for Elon on that. But just concerned about NASA's budget and how far we go with NASA's budget as far as manned space flight. This latest budget proposal from the White House gives them about another $300 million. But they keep the same budget for the next 3 years, which is basically a declining budget. With the expense, and you were just talking about ISS, it's, I think, $2 to $3 billion a year on maintenance.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure what, the SLS funding is per year. It's probably $5 billion. And then they got to fund the rest of NASA. I just, you know, they talk about this cislunar facility. There's no budgeting on that. Everybody talks about it, but there's no budgeting. There's no lunar lander. There's actually no budget for Mars. And unless they cut some of the big budget programs, I just don't see any big future on manned spaceflight, unless it comes from the commercial people. It's almost going to have to be Elon and Bezos and people like that. I just don't know if NASA's ever going to be able to get fully funded on something like this.
Well, I obviously can't answer your question, but, you know, they get $19.7 billion. And then they spread that around. So clearly SLS and ISS are your biggest users of the money. So I don't know what to say, and I, you know, Congress signs off on all this, and this is, they're fine that this is how they spend the money. They do have a focus, like going to the moon, for example, using public-private partnerships. So they fully expect to partner with the private sector on projects which will extend their reach economically, and probably partner internationally too, which also extends their reach but probably drives project costs up, as you have to deal with international issues that you don't deal with on a domestic level. I don't really know how to respond, Terry, because, you know, what would you want to cut from NASA so that more of the $19.7 billion goes to human spaceflight? So if you were the supreme dictator of power for how NASA spends its money, what would your basic segment allocation go? I mean, what would you do?
Well, I've told you about this over the years, and I know some of your listeners just absolutely love SLS, but it's $1 billion per launch. That's what they're projecting, which means about $1.5 billion.
So would you end it and redirect the money, or what in order for you to have the human spaceflight program that you want out of NASA, and if you were the most powerful almighty poopah dictator here, what would you eliminate or significantly reduce the funding to in order for human spaceflight funding to drive upwards?
Well, I think SLS eventually is going to morph into Falcon Heavy, BFR.
Well, you're not answering my
Bezos
question. Do you want to cut? Do you want to eliminate SLS? I'm asking you what you wanted to eliminate or reduce to have more money for human spaceflight.
It's got to be SLS.
Okay, and so you think eliminating SLS would give you the amount of money you want for human spaceflight, providing that's where they spent the money that they saved on SLS.
Providing that's where they spent the money.
There's no assurance of that. But what about ISS? Would you end it earlier, or would you want to see it extended, or would you want to take that money as well and put it toward human spaceflight?
Well, I hate to totally give up on ISS. It hasn't done everything everybody wanted, but it's still a good research facility. And once again, possible to a commercial establishment. I don't know if the companies and entities would come up with that kind of money to, I would hate to see it go away.
Well, it is going to go away. I mean, you know.
Well, someday.
Someday. You have a question from a listener. So Jack is in Sacramento, California, and said, Terry, SLS, with its heavy lift capability and its extremely large fairing size, offers potential payloads that Falcon Heavy cannot possibly handle. Those payloads can be really crucial for the moon as well as Mars. Do you understand that? Do you not care? Or do you think Falcon Heavy can just handle everything?
Well, I understand about the fairing and the amount of weight that it can actually handle. But they're stringing, SLS in theory sounds great. I mean, as far as capabilities, but they're running into more and more cost overruns. I mean, stretching out the potential flights. It's $1 billion a shot.
Yeah.
No matter what they do, and what we're running up against, and I've mentioned this before, is entitlement 80% of the budget. Right now, 70%. And whatever's left over has got to go to defense, NASA, all the other little departments. And that's going to get squeezed further and further and further in the future, in time. And NASA's going to have to play in the same ballpark of discretional spending. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be tough.
They don't want to cancel it, so it's here to stay, at least for a while.
Yep. You know, SLS is just a huge, huge job program. And I can imagine the people from Alabama and all of that going, okay, it's too expensive. Let's see what else we can do. It's probably gonna last, you know, for as long as the program can last. But it's definitely going to throttle back what NASA can do. Even Lori Garver, never was a big fan of hers, but she was talking about how Elon would be possibly with Falcon Heavy be one of the savers of NASA because she knows how expensive SLS is going to be. So there's a lot of nervousness on really what NASA can afford to do in the future.
Do you write your members of Congress and protest SLS? Do you do any activism at all, or you just postulate and call us?
Postulate. They're not going to listen.
Well, you never know. I tend to agree with you. I've had really raunchy luck writing members of Congress. I don't usually write them on space. I write them on health care issues, and most of the time I don't even get a reply. So as I've said many times over, I'm a frustrated and disenfranchised voter, soon to probably not be a voter. I'm so frustrated at the process. But I haven't tried writing on SLS or something like that, but I don't have a good track record getting responses. And I am really super polite and constructive in my letters to the bozos. I don't call them names or get angry with them or anything that they deserve. So
yeah, I don't even know if they read this stuff. Do they just laugh and throw it in the incinerator?
No, I think what happens is that they have aides that scan it and they tabulate what your position is on a whole host of issues. Like maybe SLS is an issue that a senator or a representative follows. So they probably keep a running total. How many people write loving SLS and support it? How many people write wanting us to cancel it? And they probably keep some kind of a running total. I don't think they read most of this stuff because they obviously don't have time, and probably 90% of the letters aren't readable anyway. But I guess if a staffer sees a letter that catches their attention or says something in it, they might bring it to the members' attention. But they probably don't have time to read all the thousands and thousands of letters that they get. But I think they do tabulate the results and the opinions.
Did you happen to see this last science committee where they had Hans, you know, the guy with a little German name, that he's from SpaceX and he does all of their quality assurance?
No, I heard about it, but I didn't see it.
And you could almost predict that. I to my wife, I said, watch the questions that he gets. When they start coming from Alabama and those areas where SLS gets all of their big funding, I mean, they beat him up. They kept asking about can we really count on SpaceX, and look at all of the failures that they had. And they were talking about the military satellite that nobody knows what happened, you know, as far as it not getting into orbit. And then they were beating up on the last failures, the one that was CRS 12 or 13, whatever it was, that failed. And they took the big string of all of the failures and said, you know, how can we trust SpaceX? And all of the bad questions were coming from those districts. I mean, you could count on hearing the questions, and it's exactly what happened.
Doug sent in an email for Jack, I guess, and I guess Doug is coming from his. Obviously coming from his perspective. What single payload mass is greater than Falcon Heavy 63.8 tons. Well, come on, Doug. That's relevant for today, but if SLS flies in 2019 or 2020, whenever it's predicted, it will fly with a larger payload tonnage than Falcon Heavy. But right now, Falcon Heavy is the largest operational rocket, but that may be short-lived unless it's canceled or continued to be delayed. So I don't really understand the point you're trying to make. But anyway, Jack, if you want to respond to Doug, I think that email was meant for you, so have at it. Matt in Germany, it's really great that, Matt, you're listening to a live show. I know you don't normally get a chance to do that. I learned that Falcon 9's payload to GTO in disposable booster mode is the same as Falcon Heavy's with reusable boosters and core stage, 8 tons. Does anyone know if there's a significant price advantage which is left for a customer who has selected Falcon Heavy over Falcon 9 in described configurations? Matt, I certainly don't know. We'll put it out there. Why don't you post it on the blog, because maybe an archive listener will know that as well. I'm sorry, Matt, I don't know, but maybe Doug knows, or if Jerry in Florida is listening, he sort of follows and lives and breathes on everything SpaceX, so he may know, but I can't answer your question. Terry, can you answer that? Do you know?
No, that's beyond what I
okay.
know.
Post it on the blog, Matt. Maybe we'll get an archive listener to comment on it. Anything else, Terry?
Quick, the first manned launch on SLS isn't the next one. It's the one after the next one.
Right. I
it's like
that. 2021 or something like that, 2022. It's down there, yeah.
It's going to be a while.
It's going to be a while.
Well, I'll be alive, David.
Thank you for the call, Terry.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So, listener, Terry has left the stage, so to speak. And, again, the email address, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Since we're not taking a break, I do want to comment on our second half Space Show sponsors. So I want to thank Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. AIAA is a sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Space 2018 is back in Orlando this year in the middle of September. Check it out. I may be going if I can arrange it, and there are no hurricanes. AIAA has over 30,000 individual members. Close to 100 countries are represented. Close to 100 corporate members are represented. Great for networking, shaping the future of aerospace every day. Look them up at AIAA.org. If you are going to be at Space 2018 in Orlando, please let me know. That may push me over the top and get me to agree to go back down there, providing there are no hurricanes, because I remember last year. Celestis is a sponsor. They are still the only provider of Memorial spaceflight services that are credible in the world. They have 5 scheduled 2018 missions. They have an Earthrise mission suborbital up aerospace from New Mexico in April 2018. They have an Earth orbital mission from the Cape, and this is with General Atomics OTB satellite. This will be a Falcon Heavy launch, and this is going to be mid-2018. They have a Luna mission, and it is confirmed. My mom and dogs are on this mission. Fourth quarter 2018 out of New Zealand on the Electron rocket. This is a Moon Express launch. There's an Earth Orbital Horizon flight mission, also fourth quarter from Vandenberg on a Falcon 9. And their first Voyager mission, fourth quarter, and the details will follow maybe next month. If you're interested, you can contact Celestis.com for more information. And again, as you just heard, I am their customer, so I give you that notice. We do have another caller. Let's see who our caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Good afternoon, David. It's Michael Listener in New Hampshire.
Hi, Michael. What's up?
Good. How'd your move go?
It's still ongoing. It's been...
you have my sympathies on that.
It's been a real struggle. So all the people that were helping me ended up in the hospital with that virus that everybody has been hearing, and that's probably how I got this really crappy bronchitis that I still have, which has stopped me cold from doing most of the physical work. So this is dragging on into being the endless nightmare move of the century, and none of my helpers who were helping me are physically fit to come back and help me. They really got sick. One of them, who is a lady who's my age, who really is great at organizing and placing things and stuff like that, almost died from it. I'm glad she's still with us, but she's still not well enough to come back and help me. And this has been since around the 20th of January, almost a month.
Not good. Hey, one reason I wanted to come in and check in anyway, it's been a while since we've talked. I don't think I really talked to you since I came on earlier in the year, but Maine is going to be planning to build a spaceport.
Okay, and why?
Well, I don't know. I just got invited. There's going to be a workshop on the 28th, and I was invited to come up. It's a two-day workshop. I'm only going to be staying one day for it, but they want to build. They think it could benefit the Maine economy. Let's put it that way. That's the underlying gist that I'm getting from it. Not only in terms of satellite launches for small sats, but also they're looking to retain a skilled workforce, to bring in more technology related jobs into the state and such. I think that's the general gist of it. Again, this is kind of a kickoff workshop for the effort that I'm actually planning on. I guess their timetable isn't to actually have it fully established until about 2025, I think. But I thought it was pretty interesting, and I was invited, and I said, you know what, I'll come up and I will I'll listen and I'll keep an open mind and see what they have to say about it. So I mean, there's going to be a lot of interesting people there. I won't go through a list of names, but it looks like they're pretty serious about it. And whether or not they just have pie in the sky dreams out thinking it through, or whether they're really seriously going to look at all the issues, I'll find out on the 28th when I go up and attend it.
What do you think the inclination would be of any orbit coming out of Maine?
Polar orbit.
Well, follow up with us. I'd be interested in knowing what they think is going to happen with this.
Yeah, I mean, bottom line is, like I said, this is going to be a kickoff workshop, just to kick off the idea. And it has a lot of different people from the community, from different aspects of the community who are going to be attending it all. So it's, like I said, I'm going to go up there and I'm going to keep an open mind and, see what they have to say. And you never know. You absolutely never know.
Absolutely. Any other legal updates? Are you ready to come back on the show? Anything significant happening that we should bring you back either in first quarter or second quarter? I only have two first quarter dates left in March.
Yeah, it's not going to be this quarter. I am just slammed right now. There's just a ton of stuff going on, not just, in the policy area. Of course, we can talk about the ISS and the budget, which right now is the latest rage on social media. There's a lot of interesting litigation that hasn't made the news as much as I think it should have. Is just very surprising. But I'll be covering this in you have my briefing letter.
Right.
So you'll find out at the end of March when I send it out.
Okay.
But yeah, there's just a lot going on right now, and I'm kind of slammed with writing commitments and turning down more writing commitments than anything, because I got so many I got to work my way through.
Okay, keep us posted. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, and let me know about Maine. That sounds really interesting for me.
Yeah, I'm very curious about it. I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully, we're not gonna get a snowstorm that day.
Okay,
talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Bye.
Listeners, that opens up our line again, and that number is 1-866-687-7223. God, it's ringing again. What an active day. I love it. I love it like this when you guys use the telephone. We got to do this on every show. Good afternoon. Welcome to Open Lines. Who are you and where are you? Hello? Hello? Wait a minute. Hello? Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. So who's calling, please?
This is John in Fremont. How are you?
Oh, okay. Now I can hear you. I'm doing okay. And what's new in Fremont then with you?
So I just saw a story by Doug Messier that Bigelow is creating a space operations company. There's going to be an announcement on Tuesday. There's no other information on it about what it is, but I just thought I'd let you know if you hadn't heard and keep an eye out for it.
No, I had not heard, but we don't know what a space operations company is.
No.
Okay, well.
No, there's no more information. It was on Parabolic Arc, but not a lot of info. Anyway, just look for that on Tuesday.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to mention, I don't know if you heard, there's a Netflix movie called Mission Control, the unsung heroes of the Apollo. I think it's the flight directors. It is the flight directors. I saw the movie last night. It's pretty good. A lot of history of the Apollo program. And
is it a download on Netflix?
Yeah.
It's a download.
Uh-huh. Okay. If you subscribe to Netflix, you can watch it.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's a download. Yeah.
Okay. I do subscribe. I'll look for it. And
pretty good. I think you'll like it.
Okay. Thank you for the heads up on that. Anything else happening? Any new other things that you're seeing? Any interesting news stories?
Not beyond the one I sent you on that new rocket company in Alameda. It's a micro satellite company, 100 kilogram payloads. Obviously, like you said, they can't test it around here.
Yeah,
so,
that's a puzzle. When you sent me that, I mean, you know, who's building a rocket in downtown Alameda? I mean, or at the old naval base, which is now a flea market site on various Saturday and Sundays. But that's weird. And I guess they can static test it, which apparently they said they did, and they're working with the fire department. But and is it amateur? I mean, where would they go to Mojave, or they take it out to Black Rock in the Nevada desert? I mean, where would they even go to launch this thing?
Well, I don't think it's amateur. I think it's a startup company. They mentioned they got 100 people on payroll there. And
Where would they launch it? They're going to go to a spaceport? They can't launch it at the Mojave spaceport because that's a runway type of operation, not vertical up and down. And
details, David.
And the launch site for Mojave for vertical is an amateur site not too far away. And then you have Black Rock, and then you're stuck with real spaceport. So, like, you know, where would they go to launch it? They can't even launch it out of New Mexico because that's a runway too.
Yeah, that's a good question. They got to find something.
I mean, the thing didn't look very impressive to me. It's on a truck, I guess, or on a flatbed or something. It looked like a giant, I mean, really giant firecracker. That's what it looked like to me. You know, I thought it was going to be one of those crazy things like Mad Max wants to ride to prove that the Earth is flat. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I thought, you know, I'd see somebody strapped onto it. It looks like a big Roman candle or something. I don't know. I'm skeptical.
yeah, we gotta see more.
Maybe information. Maybe they'd give us a tour. I don't know, but that would be fun. You didn't even know the name of the company, right? It's not even listed.
It's Astra
or Astra
like
Rocket
that.
Company. That's what I think was in the article. Astra
yeah.
Rocket Company. I may try and contact them and see if I can pry them loose to talk about it on the show, or can a couple of space show reporters come out and talk to them? You and I can meet out there.
We'll
see.
Okay.
We'll see what it's all about. But I know I'm glad you sent it to me. I had no idea that was going on in our backyard.
Pretty cool.
Okay.
Okay, David.
Have a good day.
You too, and Dan. Thanks for calling in, John, as always.
Okay. Okay. Bye-bye.
And we are back to giving out the number. First of all, email, for those of you who want to use it, Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E at thespaceshow.com. And the phone number is ringing, 1-866-687-7223. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you?
Hi, David. This is Doug from Southern California.
What's up, Doug?
Hey, just a clarification on that email that I sent. I was just trying to clarify for the emailer, what is the largest single piece of hardware that would exceed 63.8 tons? Because I don't know of any piece of hardware in its dry form that would exceed that.
Well, the SLS will eventually exceed it if it ever flies.
But there's no, the SLS would not launch any single piece of hardware in its dry form that would need that much capability. Now, in fuel, yes, but not a piece of hardware. That's my point.
Okay.
So, which leads me really to the reason why I called, and that is, do you remember when Mike Griffin was on the show several times back? He made mention, he said, the ideal propellant depot is actually an empty upper stage. Do you remember that?
No, but that's not surprising, but I trust that your memory is accurate.
Yeah, well, it makes logical sense if you think about it, because what it is that that is a not just a depot, it's an empty container, so it's like a depot waiting to be refueled, but it already has a proven engine, you know, proven propulsion system on it. So if you were to go ahead and launch a vehicle and it has an empty upper stage, but it's in LEO and it's orbiting, then if you're able to go in and refuel that, then basically you have a completely fueled upper stage now in LEO, in which case you could really deliver a lot of payload on Transmars injection. And I've been thinking about this because Elon's architecture, you know, both his MCT as well as BFR architectures, basically does this. The idea is that you launch nothing but craft and payload in an integrated form, and you end up with an upper stage portion of it. I mean, it's a two-stage rocket. So what it is the engines of the big Falcon spacecraft are used to be able to get it to orbit, and then it has an empty fuel tank. And then what happens is you launch tankers and you dock and refuel that empty tank that we serve both as an upper stage as well as the basically the Earth departure portion of that spacecraft. And depending on how many times you refuel it, you're just able to deliver more and more of that payload to Transmars injection. So it's really, I think, a brilliant sort of solution to the idea where you don't have to divide your payload into separate parts. Instead, you divide your propellant into separate parts. Well, along comes Zubrin, and you know my position in regards to SLS is that as long as we are headed towards Mars, then we need something in the category of super heavy lift vehicle. And Falcon Heavy is not in that category. You know, when you have, like, the Design Reference Architecture 5, the DRA-5 that NASA has for Mars, they have some, like, 11 or something like that launches necessary for Mars mission, then they're able to reduce it down to 7. And then I think in their latest version, or the version that I think Boeing is proposing, using solar electric propulsion, they're able to get it down to 5 super heavy lift launches for each crewed mission to Mars, to the surface of Mars. And that is a decent amount of payload necessary to launch before you start doing, you know, your first surface mission to Mars. And it strikes me that the Falcon Heavy at about being half of that capability means that you need double the launches to be able to pull that off. And at some point, it just becomes not credible that you could have a Mars surface architecture when you have something in the neighborhood of 10 or more launches to be able to, of the Falcon Heavies, to pull it off. Well, what Zubrin has done, he's just come out, I think just like yesterday. David, have you seen this? He is on the Mars Society website, and he sends it out by email. He has an op-ed that was published in, I think, the National Review. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that one, but he's coming on the show in 2 weeks to talk about all of his recent Falcon Heavy and related publications, plus his revision of the Drake formula, the Drake equation.
So my position is that if somebody can show a credible Falcon Heavy based architecture for surface missions to Mars, then I'm willing to give up on the SLS because now there's a legitimate alternative. But the only architecture I've ever heard anybody try to make for Mars surface mission with Falcon Heavy is Zubrin himself. But the problem is that the mass would have to be so low to pull it off that he actually discusses the possibility of using jockey-sized crew. And it just strikes me that if you have to talk about, small-sized people to pull off such an architecture, to me that's just not terribly credible. I can imagine that the decision-makers in Congress and the administration, they're just not going to say, well, let's give up on the SLS because there's this other architecture, but it requires jockey level sized people.
Maybe they'll have little people do it.
Yeah, but if that's the best that you can do, then we need to continue with the SLS until the BFR is really the only alternative, and the BFR is not at a level of development that the decision makers can say, okay, let's stop SLS and shift over and do a joint program with BFR. It's just not at that level. There's a lot of technical challenges that need to be proven with BFR before we can make that decision. Well, Zubrin has just published an article in which he is basically using Elon's concept of refueling an orbit. And he's saying, hey, what if we were to refuel the Falcon Heavy in orbit? And when you do that, a refueled Falcon Heavy is basically at a capability of the SLS. And so it's a fascinating thing. I mean, I doubt that there is actually a scientific paper, and I'm not even sure if there's even a simulation of that, like in orbit or somebody done it with Kerbal Space Program. I don't know that anybody's done that, but it strikes me as being an approach that holds potential and I think deserves to be looked into.
Well, we'll ask him about it when he's on the show.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
If you can listen live, call in. If not, send in advanced questions, and I'll be sure to ask him about it.
What day of the week is that show?
Tuesday on the 13th of March.
Oh, I might be free, actually. So I look forward to that.
Okay.
Thanks,
Doug. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
So, listeners, we're coming up on a two-hour show, which we're going to end at. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223 if anybody else is out there would like to give us a quick call. And, of course, email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. While I'm waiting to see if somebody else does want to give us a call, let me tell you what we've got going. So as I said, there's no show Monday and no show Friday, but Tuesday Mark Whittington returns, and he has coined a program called the Great Moon Debate in Utah, and this is because Romney is running for Senate, and Romney went on the record during the previous primary when he ridiculed Newt for his moon development comments. And Mark has been challenging Romney through op-eds and things like that to talk about the moon program. And so I read what he has to say, and some of it I thought was pretty interesting. So I invited Mark back on the show to talk about it. So that's what the Great Moon Debate in Utah is all about. I seriously doubt the prospective senatorial candidate Romney will have anything to say about the moon. But it'll be a fun discussion. And we have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you?
Oh, this is John in Fort Worth.
Go for it.
Well, I just thought, I guess this the Mars bomb thing really got everybody all upset or something, huh?
Well, no, that there are people that think Brandenburg is a wackadoodle, and they think they understand and question, you know, his research conclusions, if they are research. Again, they're hypothesis conclusions, I guess. And, you know, here's the deal. So for me, this is just for me individually, I have really high standards for posting something on the blog, and I would never post something and try to come off as an expert when I'm not. So if I wanted to post an opinion on the blog, anybody's blog, the Space Review or anything, I would say, guys and gals, this is an opinion that I have, and it is not based on science or fact, but I suspect it has merits, but it is my opinion, and I want to share that with you. So I would play full disclosure and full transparency and post as an unfounded, scientifically factual opinion. That's just what I would do. But on the blog, and it's not just the Space Show blog, it's almost every blog, people who don't know their ass from a hole in the ground, pardon my French, Spanish, and German all put together here, post as experts and authorities, and they are not, and they mislead people. Now, most people don't deliberately want to mislead people, so don't go out and get me wrong and think that because you're posting on the blog, you're evil. There is only one person in recent times on the Space Show that I have discovered through his personal email responses to me purposely misleads people. I have not gone public with that, although at one time when it happened, I said I was going to build a whole blog posting show around it, and I would go public with the private emails that were sent to me. I have not done that yet, and I have not been willing to bust a guy in public. But that's only one person that I have come up with who purposely could care less if he misleads people. Now, you know, I don't do a political blog, so my hunch is if I were doing a political blog, everybody would be misleading everybody. So that's a different thing. But I just have really high standards, so I would just not be posting as an authority on something when I'm not. But people post on the blogs about everything under the sun, and many of them do post in a way that they sound as if they're real authorities. And they are not. And so that kind of bothers me. But look, I'm a throwback from another era. I understand that. And, you know, people think that Brandenburg is a fringe character and a wackadoodle. He did years ago. He was very strong on Cydonia and very strong on the Face of Mars stuff. And, you know, he's been on other fringe things. And I've read their faux science breakdowns of interrogating his work on, say, the nuclear bomb theory on Mars, and they criticize him for it and, you know, attack him for it and say it's unfounded and it's crazy, but none of them have another hypothesis for Xenon 129 on Mars. Nobody says how it could have gotten there or where it comes from, but they're real quick to go after John and call him names and do what blogosphere people love to do. And yeah. So I'm not a scientist. God knows I'm not a nuclear weapons guy or a plasma physicist. You know, if somebody out there has factual information or plausible data on where Xenon 129 comes from, post it out there and tell us and challenge Brandenburg with some facts. Otherwise, maybe someday we'll know whether he's a wackadoodle on this or not.
Hypothesis. I mean,
yeah, and I hope I'm still doing the space show when we're able to prove or disprove his hypothesis or elevate it to a theory or whatever the next scientific step is. I'd love to do a show on that new information. I hope I'm still around when new information comes. But we need to get boots on the ground on Mars, and we need to get them to locations where Brandenburg has talked about this, and somebody needs to be willing to spend the money and prioritize to do that. So, that, you know, there are tons and tons of challenges and roadblocks and all sorts of things that make it unlikely.
Well, I mean, it seems like there's two possibilities for his idea if it were to be considered seriously. Either there would have to be a civilization on Mars that was advanced enough to make a nuclear bomb and decide to make a doomsday device or something and set off a couple of them, you know, or the other possibility was basically some alien space navy flew in here and bombed the place. I mean,
that's why it's so preposterous.
I mean, ever know, you know, maybe they were just target practice for an alien space navy that's just flying in going, hey, let's fire up a couple of the big ones here. That's a dumb planet.
Well, if they are advanced in technology enough to get to Mars, wherever they came from, why in the hell would they be using a hydrogen bomb? You'd think they'd have advanced weapons way beyond the capability of a nuclear thermal weapon that we developed in the 1950s.
You would tend to think that, I guess, have the ability to do that. I mean,
but it is fun, and Brandenburg is a really fun guest, and he is a real scientist. And come on, people, tell us where xenon 129 comes from. I mean, that's what makes it so fun. It's either a supernova, or it's a thermonuclear blast, or where does it come from? Factually, where does it come from? And so,
well,
Brandon,
if it's a supernova, why wouldn't it be on Earth too? Because we would be in the same.
Well, there hadn't been a supernova on Earth, and there hasn't been.
Well, there wasn't one on Mars, but I mean, if there's a supernova in the region that put it on Mars, you'd think it would also have affected Earth and the.
Well, probably, yeah, but so that's what makes this all so much fun from my perspective, because it is so outrageous and so. Out there, and yet nobody can posit an alternative for how xenon 129 got on Mars in these high ratio proportions.
Yeah, so, well, I think it's kind of a provocateur in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely.
But he comes up with interesting things. I mean, you know, like the elements of his gem theory and the predictions he's getting that way with the kind of basis he's using is very interesting.
Well, and he's giving now peer-reviewed talks and being published on the revisions to his gem theory. So, and he says he's discovered the gravity constant, big G. So I'm not qualified to opine on any of that, but you talked to him about it when he was on the show.
Yeah. Well, because he's doing it from basic atomic physics type inputs, he's getting something that's something different, like the gravitational constant out, to a very high degree of accuracy, and we assume his methodology is approximate. Even he does. So, yeah, that would be good. I also thought on this whole Falcon Heavy thing for the Falcon Heavy advocates. It seems like, you know, I guess one issue is about, there was an issue about fairing size. I mean, I guess, is there any problem with the Falcon Heavy launching the Orion spacecraft to the moon? Is that a viable idea?
I don't think so. I think
to land on, just to orbit it, you know.
Well, when I was doing more frequent shows with Lockheed on Orion, and I would ask if they could launch on a Falcon vehicle, he said it wasn't being designed for that. And so I don't know the exact answer on that, but my hunch is probably for competitive reasons it's not compatible with a Falcon vehicle of either kind, but I don't know the answer to that to be precise.
Yeah.
Let's
rule that out for the Falcon advocates that are out there.
I don't know. I mean, you might be able to.
For them to. They could talk about something the blogger.
Well, somebody out there, Google it. Can a Falcon Heavy launch Orion? And I mean, it could launch it in terms of payload mass, but I'm not sure.
The fairing size issue might be the other issue.
Yeah, because the SLS fairing is really huge.
And the other, that's one thing. And the other idea would be if you had a lander, if you could launch the lander into lunar orbit with a Falcon Heavy, and then presumably the propulsion system on the lander would have to have enough to achieve orbit or something like that, and then you could rendezvous up there, you know, between the human crew and the lander and two launches. That's an idea that they might propose, you know, the Falcon Heavy advocates, you know. I've thought about it, but I haven't really done much with it. I just thought, you know, that's interesting. The current Falcon Heavy is more capable than the original, you know, advertised. They've stretched the Falcon quite a bit since the early days. I've noticed that. And look at what they're talking now isn't what they were talking a few years ago. So,
Doug sent in a note saying geologists have identified a place on Earth with a natural nuclear reactor. Existed, have there been any discussions by anyone on the findings on Mars due to natural nuclear reactor? And Brandenburg has discussed that at length,
yeah.
As have others. And Xenon 129 is not a product of that, but there have been natural nuclear reactors on Earth and possibly on Mars as well. But the troubling thing is the isotope 129. So it either comes from a supernova, or it is a byproduct of a hydrogen bomb, as we know on Earth. So extrapolating that to Mars, how in the hell did a hydrogen bomb go off on Mars? And nobody wants to accept that, and it's preposterous, and it puts you into the beyond the fringe category. But it is a lot of fun, and I really, really enjoy Brandenburg's show. And I enjoy talking about this stuff. So,
what about measurement error? That was one thing that was mentioned about those papers on the subject. That is a device measuring everything accurately. Is that possible?
Well, that's part of what the SAR instrument on Curiosity researchers talk about, is could they have errors in their measurement? And this is why they want to have more study and more research. And they apparently are going to be able to do more work in this area with Mars 2020. So maybe some things will be clarified with better measurement. But, yeah, that is talked about as something that needs to be verified in further research.
I mean, like when they had that one thing at CERN where they thought they had something that was going faster than light, it turned out it was an error in measurement, basically, you know, of some sort. You know, it wasn't violating the light barrier. So there you have it. I mean, it's a possibility that doesn't, you know, go to extreme hypotheses.
Well,
but
it's verified in Viking data, and it's verified in the SARS data. So can they get more refined measurements that will give them better information? I think that they're hoping to be able to do that on future Mars missions. So, yeah, that's absolutely in the mix out there.
Yeah, because The only other issue, what they're really talking about is really high energy neutrons that produce this. I think the fusion neutrons that are like significantly higher than the fission neutrons, and I think that's what Brandenburg was saying. And
yeah,
that makes sense. You're not going to get that with a nuclear with a pile of nuclear elements that react, you know, by fission.
Anything else? We're getting close to the end of the
program. I guess that's it for this time, but if these guys could come up with a mission using a couple of Falcon Heavies, and you know, that would be an interesting concept, although the problem is going to remain that politically I think that SLS is the program of record is going to stay that way for a while. I mean, just because of politics and institutional factors, you know.
Okay. John,
all right.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
Listeners, that's probably it for today. We're at the two-hour point for our program. I was telling you about shows. I got through talking about Mark Whittington, but Dwight Stephen Benecki is on Sunday with his new history book on the Apollo-Soyuz test project, which is really interesting. Marcia Smith is on regarding the budget issues Monday, February 26th. Pascal Lee is returning, and he's going to talk about that controversial SETI paper on Mars water and stuff that was put out and that Paul Spoudis refuted. Jerry Black wrote a Space Review article on why we should dump SLS. He's coming on March 2nd. Alice Glenn from the Starship Conference, talking about living in extreme environments. She grew up in Barrows, Alaska. Talk about an extreme environment, way extreme. And she does some extrapolation to living in space. Some interesting shows coming up, and we hope you will be able to listen to every one of them. Doug posted a note, so let's see, Orion capsule diameter 16.5 feet, Falcon Heavy fairing diameter 17 feet, Orion capsule 10.4 tons, Falcon Heavy TMI capability 17.8 tons. So see what happens with that. I don't know what ULA or Lockheed's plans are for putting an Orion on a Falcon launch vehicle. I haven't done a program with the Orion folks in a while because they have not been attending the AIAA meetings, and then the one last year in Orlando was canceled, and the one this year, I'm surprised that it's going to be back in Orlando, but it is in Orlando in the middle of September. Hey, John, if you're still listening, are you interested in going back to Orlando if there's no hurricanes? Anyway, listeners, that's it for today. I want to thank everybody for their calls and for their emails. I appreciate it. And again, no show tomorrow because it's President's Day, a national holiday in the United States. Back with Mark Whittington on the Great Moon Debate in Utah Tuesday night. Everybody have a great week. Keep it safe. Enjoy the holiday if you celebrate it. And keep looking up. Goodbye from all of you who called, all of you who emailed, and myself and the space shuttle.